Tonight on Arena, Ronan O'Snoddy and Miles O'Reilly play live in studio songs from the new album, The Beautiful Road, and Kevin Curran on his new novel, Youth. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And delighted to have in studio with me this evening two of the giants of Irish music today, Ronan O'Snoddy, songwriter, composer, musician, poet and founding member and lead vocalist of the group Keela, and Miles O'Reilly, musician, composer, former member of the band Juno Falls. He's also a video and filmmaker, working with people like Lisa Hannigan, Glenn Hansard, Villagers and James Vincent McMorrow. In 2021, Miles and Ronan collaborated on Ronan's album Tá Gamay, where Miles was the recording engineer, producer and mixer. But now in 2023, they're back with a full musical collaboration, a new album called The Beautiful Road. It'll be released on Friday, July the 20th, but delighted, as I say, that Miles and Ronan are with me in studio to give us a sense and going to play some of the music live for us, which is great. There must have been something good in that initial collaboration, Tá Gamay, Víse Gamay, Gudjevin or Noe.
Yeah, and there was for us as well. People's responses have been huge. We got to tour around the country and played some beautiful gigs like Inishbofin, or eventually it felt like there was a wave built up between us.
Got to see a lot of very beautiful places.
Yeah.
And played to a lot of very relaxed people. It seems like after the pandemic, people are quite chilled out and they like to be massaged. So we play pretty chilled out massaging music, really, don't we?
Yeah, at the minute.
And in terms of what had happened during, like, you were working on that more, I suppose, Miles, on that first album, on more on the production side. Could you already see the possibilities of things you wanted to do with Ronan on a more collaborative level?
Well, I'd say the first album was no different. This album has been no different than the first one. I just would have been quite afraid to use my name in the initial stages to say that, you know, that we were collaborating to such an extent and unwilling to come back into the spotlight. So I gave Ronan the full go at it there. But after a year of gigs and the popularity of the album and the compliments and the people saying nice things and Ronan screaming over to me in the middle of the gig, sing, and me singing more, I'm like, you know what? Yeah, I might put my name in there as well. Yeah.
So I would guess too, it wasn't only shouting over to him in the middle of the gigs, sing, Ronan. If I know you anyway at all, I'm pretty certain that you were saying to him, come on, Miles, this isn't just me, this is the two of us.
Yeah.
Let's tell people the truth.
Yeah, that's, very, very, very much.
That's
so
quite Freudian, because he would be very gentle, but in my mind, I'd be
screaming. Silent screaming.
Well, now, it's funny that you're talking about silent screaming there, because the new album, The Beautiful Road, in some ways, silence is a hugely important part of it. Where did you go about making this album? Because that tells us something about the nature of you found yourself a little bohon
in Roscommon first, and by the lakes, a big log cabin actually, beautiful thing. And then we went down to Camas Farm in West Cork and did another few days there in another beautiful place.
Isolated, away from everything.
Yeah.
And when you're isolated and away from everything like that, what did you begin to hear, or how did you begin to hear that you don't hear when you have the bomb bomb of the horns and the sounds of the buses?
Few things
all
happening.
Of those things going
I suppose
on.
I remember things in reel to reel. So sometimes what happens in my mind is I can hear the reels going backwards. Like if I'm on a long drive sometimes, I can hear all the conversations going backwards in me. Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that happens for a day or two, but when you're isolated, eventually it gives you a chance to actually listen, you know. So
you use all your processing power to process your creativity. So you're turning off all the apps on your phone that you've left on. You're turning off I've got to drop the kids there, I've got to do my shopping, what am I going to have for dinner? You're turning off those apps, so your brain is using its full processing power to think about the songs and the music and the audio. So we really get the most out of Ronan.
Great.
Like really, when we tear him away from his life and just put him somewhere, just think about the music, just think about how you feel. How do I feel? Let's play the keyboard. Ah, that's how I feel.
That's interesting in terms of the first song that you're going to perform for us this evening, Níl in Asperum. I suppose a translation, something close to Ronan. There's nothing lacking in me. I don't need anything at the moment. Maybe explain how that philosophy leads into the album and to this song.
Oh, how would I put all of that right? Níl in Asperum. I wanted to. Sometimes the thing happens to you before you have a decision how you want to say something. I suppose I just wanted to leave a message to me ma to say I'm all right. I'm not short anything. And when someone passes, you get to consider the, you know, you're left with what? And then as you look at it, you're left with so much. Eventually you realise you've been given stuff for years.
Yeah, you know? And I can understand why that's difficult to express. That's why it's there in a song. But it did strike me listening to the song. It's a love song. That's precisely what it is. The fact that it's love for a mother is another thing, but it is a love song. That's precisely what it is. I know this is probably a difficult one to talk about, so why don't I let you go over to the chair and you can sing the song and all of the expression that you're talking about, and that expression of love, I think people will hear it. Miles O'Reilly and Ronan O'Snoddy, Níl in Asperum.
Níl in Asperum, war go hug to dum, made a hug to dum, ben a will a gum, Níl in Asperum, ben a will a num, ben a will a num.
Níl in Asperum, absolutely beautiful. You can come back over from there. Gajasar fad. Níl in Asperum, the vor a hug to dum, and veda hug to dum, behena will a gum. I am not without you because you gave to me all that you gave to me.
They're extraordinary lyrics. They're extraordinary lyrics, Ronan, and deeply moving to listen to. I noticed just at the end of the.
And that was a shortened version that you did for us. You very kindly, in the midst of that emotional outpouring, that it must have been very emotional even to sing it, I just gave you a thumbs up and you wrapped up the end of the phrase. But there was a lovely out-breath, which is kind of that type of breath and that kind of very natural sound is all over the album, in fact.
Mm. Yeah, we've been encouraging each other. It's been great to work together. We've been encouraging each other to be courageous with our ideas, like to go with the first idea. So sometimes if I have a breath idea, if I'm with another sound engineer, I mightn't be that exposing of my ideas. I might go and try and couch it in a different way. But the way we're working together at the minute, it seems that the more ideas we have, and if we look after each other's ideas, it kind of elevates it. Like we're in, you know, so we'll use a lot of breaths and a lot of
hand rubbing,
sounds.
Yeah,
a lot of high end. We, for recording, especially when we were in West Cork, we heard a lot of wind and we heard the trees and the leaves and they all, and the sea, especially the sea. And they all made that same high end kind
frequency.
Of very, very comfortable frequencies. And you think about a car, a road would make the same frequencies, but they wouldn't be as comfortable sounds.
Yeah, it's amazing that the sound of the wind, I heard you talking earlier, I think, Ronan, about the idea of, you know, the car tires, I think it was on a video. It's in a video that I was looking at earlier on the day. Car tires going along the road make a similar sound. It's not as relaxing as the sound of the wind, is it?
Yeah.
Interestingly, it's not. And there's something, it's somehow the two of us are learning the same thing about certain things in different ways. Like sometimes there's, let's say, algorithms, or there's a K-oscillator, or sometimes with visuals there was fractals, or people are, you know, how you can be hypnotized by rain falling on a windscreen or a fire, and the unpredictability, like the random. So,
try the same thing can be done with audio. If you close your eyes and if you really listen, you can see that beauty of nature and just those high end frequencies.
Absolutely, and I suppose that high end is just it's easier on the ear. I mean, if you think about a big rumble, you know, that's always going to have a kind of, that's low end.
Nobody hears it next door. You know,
the high end thing carries.
Well, we whisper in high end as well.
Yeah, and there's a lot of emotion that's that's actually conveyed in our breaths when we talk to each other that we don't even realize it's in between the words, where we can hear if you're nervous, so we can hear if you're angry. Yeah.
If we're in an agitated state, the breaths will be shorter. We can't take the deep breath to relax ourselves.
But Ronan's an expert at that.
Also interested, Ronan, because we should point out you were playing the guitar and Miles was on a whole raft of electronics there in front of him making those sounds that we heard underneath the song. But the rhythm that we heard was coming from the bottom of your legs.
Oh, yeah, my bells, shakers and bells, yeah.
Because the bells are important across the album as well. And particularly there's another song. Which is the song that you have the dancer in? Oh, yes.
It is this
song as well. Yeah. So just tell us about the dancer and where you went to make the video, because Miles was part of that as well, obviously.
Yeah, Junior Yusuf Mufritel is the name. I was with Keila in Paris about 3 years ago. And the woman who runs the Irish Cultural Centre over there.
Nora.
Is it Nora? I know I can get names wrong. Good, Nora. she's brilliant, you know. Yeah. But she put Mufritel and myself together to do a video. And we did a video, and Dermot Armstrong was there, D. Armstrong's young fella who plays with us. But so we did a video for the Cultural Centre, I had met Mufritel a few times previous from Nora asked us to meet up and to talk about a collaboration. And there's subtle things or characteristics that I really admire in people. Yeah. And if I see them in people, it's like looking at someone through I see them large. I see.
Yeah.
And he's one of those people. And so I was talking to him about doing this video. For nearly a year, even though it looks completely, and it is natural, but
it has a real feeling as if you just we're talking, having some ideas going down in the car. Yeah. You're down near Loch Crewe, aren't you?
Yeah, up in the Cairns in Loch Crewe. But yes, it was as you see it. But there was a lot of to and fro, and I was explaining what I'm doing with the song.
And it rained every 20 minutes. So every 20 minutes, three of us were under an umbrella.
And the other side of that is Nora Hickey, by the way, is the person you're talking about.
That's right,
Excuse me. The other thing about the dancing and the Loch Crewe side of things, within the film itself, there's a lovely dedication, in fact, to Cliona. To Cliona's mother, that you just slip in. Maybe I'll ask you to tell us the visuals, Miles. It's unfair to ask Ronan, I think.
Well, that was just very naturally Ronan in the car picking up the mass card for his mother and showing it to Mufritel. And I know it's very difficult to Ronan to speak about that. I heard him on the phone to Mufritel for the first time explaining what the song's about. And it was difficult for Ronan to say those things. So it was easily communicated for me just to film the moment when he shows him the mass card and put that in the video and put that in the film, you know.
It also strikes me within that song, I'm sorry to come back to you on it, Ronan. I don't want to be upsetting you in any way. But what really strikes me is there's a kind of a repetitive, almost meditative type of repeating of phrases within it that seems to be a kind of way that you might be coming to terms with stuff in that kind of meditative repetition.
That's kind of, yes, that's what I'm doing. And more prayer-like than displaying too much.
Yeah.
I suppose and it doesn't really kneel to a Kurishakuram to say tell. But I am only getting used to it. You know, getting used to talking about my ma. But
it's only 11 months since she died. Yeah.
When I was a kid, I'll try and tell a story quickly, Sean, if I can. So Enda Burns took me up to the Cairns, I thought, for the first time, and about at the age of 20. And I went up there and I remember walking up the hill to him and saying, God, this is so strange, Enda. I know this place inside out. I bet you there's a big chair there. I bet you if I run around this side, there'll be a little plush going into it. a little gate, and I bet you there'll be another chair there, and that's my chair. There's a, because it's in a cross shape and has a, you know, and there's a hole at the top, and the sun comes in, and then it was looking at me sideways, and I was thinking, oh, I sound like I'm having reincarnation. So I drove home to, called into me ma, and I said, you wouldn't believe this, man, but I went up to this place, Loch Crew, and I knew every blade of grass, I knew the gorse, I knew the whole thing inside there, and the little seat, and she just laughed, and I said, what? And she was like, oh yeah, I used to bring you up there when you were a toddler. And I just went, all right, so I know the place.
That explains the line, Nealian Asperum, the Vorgor hug to them and major hug to them, because you gave me all that you gave to me. You could argue, hug she and Aaron Shin, the
expression.
Now, on kid Oronella and Aaron Jernokatog, on all more Jevon, I'm saying, big deep breath. Cut her shoe and show.
Again, when we were in Paris, at that time with Keila, we met this fella there, Commandant Dan Harvey, a peacekeeper. And we engaged, we'd meet in for breakfast, you know, in this place, you meet for breakfast, and we had a conversation that developed every day. Where we meet for breakfast, maybe say a few things that might rub each other the wrong way. He'd go into his world, he was writing a book, and I'd go into my world, I was rehearsing with Keila. I might meet him in the evening and we'd continue the conversation in the morning. Eventually it grew into a conversation, maybe from my point of view, of great admiration and delighted to be put right about things. You know, I felt some of my outlooks were maybe a bit juvenile, and maybe I put them towards him on purpose to get him agitated, just to bring him out of himself. But I came away with a real deep respect, and I felt very proud that from this little country, people like him go out and represent us. They don't have cameras on them, but you can't, as a human, you can't do any more than what they're doing, which is putting themselves in the line of fire on behalf of other people. So, and then before we left to Paris, I remember he said, listen, write us a song, write a tune for the peacekeepers. And I said, I will. So, you know, we were playing tunes with Tequila, and we were saying, we do this, the peacekeepers parade, or we were using the phrase, and so many tunes are floating in between us and Tequila. Some are getting played. And then I, on my drives or walks, I was composing this song. Wondering, all right, well, if I really think about it, and this is a person from here going out into the world to be shot at, you know, or to engage in negotiating peace, which is real, real life stuff, what would I possibly say? You know, there's this shrinking feeling of, oh, the task is too big. But so I just sent that to Commandant Dan Harvey last week. I said, I just sent him the track, and I says, look, I finished that. I hope you like it, or have a think and see, would that be suitable as something to sing for some soldiers?
This is what I'd say to them.
And all more giant. Right, so big, deep breaths. Well, and all more giant. On virtue of Trasna as Nishkajina Kahiraka, killed over to the music chairs to give us big, deep breath. And all more giant. From Ronan O'Snoddy and Miles O'Reilly.
She on head road, a taller than I've got done, so the Hunna and all more dying now, and to stock the bundle. She on Dara Road at all, then I've got done so the Hun on Tunnel Moor dying son, a squealer, a shamach, oak leave on the brolach, to on anish.
An All More Giant, the title of that song from the Beautiful Road, new album from Ronan O'Snoddy and Miles O'Reilly. It will be released on Friday, 20th of July via Claddagh Records, and Ronan and Miles will be touring in September and October, performing at Electric Picnic in Laois, venues in Kerry, West Cork, Dublin and Donegal. Gurumahagav Míle Maithagav Beirt as Fáileng Anocht. Gurumahagav Ronan agus Miles. Kevin Curran describes himself as a teacher first, a writer second, author of two previous novels, Citizens and Beatsploitation. He teaches in the same school, which he himself went to, in Balbriggan, North County Dublin, a place that he calls the future of Ireland. One of the most diverse towns in the country, has also been ravaged by the financial crash of 2008 and the impact of COVID. It's to these streets that Kevin turns as the setting for his new novel, Youth, having written about young people before it in his short stories. Here he brings together four distinct voices, all on the cusp of adulthood, navigating their future. Delighted that Kevin Curran is with me in studio right now. I suppose, Kevin, given what I said about where you're from, where you work, where you teach, and the setting of the novel, is it inevitable? Am I right in saying that Briggs would get into it? I'd be shot if that's the wrong way to say it.
No, you're all right.
It is Briggs for Balbriggan, yeah?
The Brig. Oh, I think... Miss Caldwell yesterday from the World Cup in Australia said up the Brig when they were doing their jerseys, so it's the Brig. The Briggs are Brig, yeah. Although my mum would kill me for saying that, because she's always saying, why'd you have to write about Balbriggan, you know? You not write about somewhere else, you know?
But did you find then, despite your mum's exhortations, that you just had to write about Balbriggan?
Yeah. When you're in the place, and you're teaching in the place, and you see what I see every day, and I've been saying that to people, and people look at you and say, oh, you know, is it true? And I have a friend in Australia said the exact same thing. He says, is it really like that? And I said, yeah, it is. You know, you have to see it now. You've got to give a context to where I teach. I say to people, my fifth year and sixth year class would have 50% first and second generation immigrants in the classroom in front of me, and maybe 40% Black Irish students would be in the classes that you'd have. So it's an incredible mix, and it's a mix that I don't think you'd see around the country. So from that perspective, you kind of have to write about it, and I couldn't not write about it, you know.
What is it about that mix and the diversity of the students that you teach that makes it, the answer is in the question, but it does make it a very exciting place, I'm sure, to teach, but also to be writing about.
Yeah, you know, and I tried to hold off for so long. You know, my first book was 10 years ago, and it was a different angle and kind of multicultural Ireland, and I said, all right, I'll leave it there. But the longer then you're doing it, and the longer you're witnessing this, and you're talking with the students in the class, and they're kind of scratching their head going, why are we reading books about, of Mice and Men? Why are we reading books about different areas?
Yeah.
Like, why is, and those books in themselves have problems that they don't really want to face into. So why is there no books about, you know, our experiences or kind of Black Irish experience in Ireland and things like that? So I, as a writer, my line was like, in 20 years time, someone would say to me, you call yourself a writer, but you never thought about writing about Balbriggan, and I can't turn around and say, well, I was scared to, you know.
Are they now asking you, am I in your book, sir?
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
And are they?
No, they're not. No, you'd have about, I'd teach about five princesses. Princesses a character.
Princesses one of the characters.
Yeah, you'd have about five princesses a year for the last 14 years, so they're an amalgamation. They're all there, although I did get students to read the book before came to publication as recently as last November, October.
All right.
Just for, you know.
All right. Well, listen, hold that thought, and we'll talk a little bit more about Major Rash Igoral, Kevin Curran, Fuin Lauer, Youth, his new novel, Youth. Welcome back to Arena. Kevin Curran still sitting in front of me because we've lots to talk about in terms of the novel, Youth. So now that we've got the Brig out of the way, and your mother's going, oh no, and he's written about it, and now he's going to call it the Brig on air as well.
Yeah, I'm in trouble again.
Let's get a sense of, because it is four young voices that you give to us here, and like the diversity of Balbriggan itself and your own teaching situation, Kevin, these four characters come from diverse the diversity is throughout the four of them and their friends. Talk to me, Princess, I suppose, since you mentioned her, because initially it sounds like quite a pejorative term, but far from it.
Yeah, Princess, I would have written a short story about Princess, I think about 2016, for a kind of a magazine called Penny Dreadful in Cork. I think they folded just, they were going to publish it, and they folded just before they published it. So it gave me time to work on it then. But as I was saying before the break, Princess then became obviously a big part of the book. She's a quarter of the book, so she'd be a good 100 pages, well, 50, 60 pages. And to make sure I was on point, around about October last year, I said some students had heard about the book and the rest.
Yeah.
And they said to me, and I always give them a shout out because they did so well for me, Glory, Tomalina and Queenie. And they said, can we read it? And I said, of course, yeah. But like, you know, do you want to read it? Yeah, we'd love to, because they want to read about
their own experience.
Yes. Yeah. So after school, for once a week after school, I'd leave them to it. I'd give them a few photocopies and throw it on the desk and leave them. I didn't want to stand over them as they were reading it, you know. And I'd come back into the room. I'd come back into the room afterwards, after about half an hour, and they'd all look at me like, with these eyes, like, how does this lad know this? And they'd look and say, how? And they'd mark the manuscript and say certain things. And then at the end of it all, I said to them, so they'd finished the book and they were like, wow, this is amazing. We want to read the rest of the characters, because they didn't know what was going on with the other characters.
Yeah.
I said to them, well, they were literally the perfect target audience.
So you gave them princesses section first. Yeah. Princess is this young black woman.
Yeah, yeah.
She's just coming towards the end of school. She's very bright at school, wants to become a pharmacist and has real aims to do that.
Yeah. Nigerian-Irish. She's born in Ireland. Her mother's Nigerian. And the girls are Nigerian-Irish, the same. So I said to them, is there anything I've left out that you feel is missing from this?
Yeah.
And they just looked at each other and laughed. And they said that she needs to do more chores. Chores, I said. Okay, so I got on to the editor and said, we got to put a few more chores in there. But other than that, I was on the money. And then you had the language element from Angel. Angel's another guy. He's Congolese Irish, born in Ireland as well, but he's kind of got the drill, the London slang. And this is the thing that...
Yeah, he's in the music, or certainly he's playing around in the music business.
But he was... His language, I had to cut it off at around 2022, because the language changes so quick and kids' slang changes so quick. And if you're talking to people who are reading it in Donegal and Cork, they'd say, this isn't real, this can't be real. But it's real language. The kids are kind of pulling from London drill slang, they're pulling from African slang, Dublin slang, and it is a unique mix. But I got it right, and again I gave it to another student, Yinka, to read and make sure that I was on point with the Angel chapters.
Yeah.
And then we had the audiobook, and I played a bit of the audiobook to some kids. And
who reads the audiobook?
The audiobook was done before main four incredible actors. Gabriel Adarussi, who's doing the Druid O'Casey now.
Oh, he did Angel. We'll be down there, and we'll be talking to a part of the big program on Gabriel, the Druid O'Casey on Thursday the 27th, in fact.
He did Angel, and he was incredible. And I gave him some pieces to listen to from YouTube, and he'd have the in-ears, and before we were recording in the studio, he was getting the voice ready and the rest. I played a few students a short piece of his of a minute, and the kids were kind of looking. Now, I didn't tell him it was mine, and they said, oh, that's whatever his older brother talking, isn't it? Because the language, they were so in tune with the slang that they knew that language was from 2021, 2022. It wasn't 2023 contemporary.
And that's how quick the language is changing.
But I was like, grand, I'm good. But then I stopped and said, well, that's actually me. I wrote that. And there's no way you wrote that. Even at the launch, we had a few of my old students came, and they came up to me and they were like, Yinka was there. And a few of the guys were like, sir, did you, because Gabriel was good enough to read at the launch.
Right.
He read, and they were like, did you really, like, how?
Did you really write that?
You got to listen, you know. Yeah. My teacher friends say, like, we hear this language all the time in the classroom. We tell them to be quiet, whereas you tell them to keep going.
Well, I'm not going to attempt. How do you say all right hour? And what exactly does it mean?
All right hour, all right hour lad. It's just a hello. It's a simple Bob Regan hello, you know. And in the novel,
and is that a tradition? Is that an old style hour? This goes back to Bob Regan for the last 15, 20 years, doesn't it?
50 years, hour lad. Yeah. All right, our lad. Yeah, all right, our.
So, all right, our.
Yeah, and it becomes then a point of contention in the book. It's all about language and
who owns the language. That phrase. Yeah, because you mean you've touched on the characters of Angel, the young man who is big into the music business and may or may not be shafted by his music business friends, and Princess, who is the young woman who has this desire to study pharmacy and become a chemist in time, and it does bring up that subject of. Because that idea of appropriation, in fact, is right there in that phrase, all right, are. Because there's a bundle of young white Irish who are basically saying to Angel and his pals and Princess and her pals, you can't say all right, are.
Yeah, it should be wagwan or...
That's not your phrase. Yeah. Don't be trying to take that from us. Did you have worries? And I know you said you spoke to, you know, particularly in terms of the character Princess, you spoke to four or five of your young students who wouldn't be that far off some of the aspects of the Princess character. Did you have worries about culture appropriation? There's so much debate about writing only what you know.
Of course. But you can only hold off from my perspective, you could only hold off for so long. And then you're looking around you and you're saying, someone has to start telling these stories. You know, now, if I'd gone in and just done a Princess book, 300 pages of Princess, that would have been, and I wouldn't mind, but a certain reviewer said that he'd love to see a full book of Princess, but I'm not going to be doing that. But you're kind of standing back, who can write this story of too white Irish, too black Irish. Well, the teenagers themselves can't because they're too invested in it. And then when you look around and say, well, who's in a position to do this? And I'm lucky enough, and I am aware that I'm very lucky. The school I teach in makes me incredibly lucky and privileged to see this play out in front of me for the last 10 years and how it's also changed. But you have to go at it the right way, and you have to go at it with, I don't know, integrity, and you have to come down to the level, and you have to be true with what you see, and you'll be found out very soon. Even I had an hour's discussion with Florence Adebambo, who did she's an actress and she's done a few excellent films as well. She was
and did she do the character of Princess for the audiobook?
And she was with Letitia Wright in a film only recently, and we spoke for an hour, and I was kind of nervous when I was about to speak to her because she had read the script obviously, and again, she was saying, wow, I've never read anything like this before. She was in an RTE show as well, and it was about direct provision. Yeah. And then the film she was in was about direct provision.
Yeah.
But she was saying, I've never read something about just literally a black Irish girl walking through the streets and encountering what they encounter. And so once you can kind of get that right and you can write it properly, I suppose I can hopefully get away with it and do it right.
Yeah, because the other two characters, because they bring up interesting topics. Dean and Tanya are the two, there's lots of white Irish and there's lots of black Irish. There's, you know, there's a great diversity of characters across the, because there's a whole school full of people, a whole young people walking the streets of the city of Balbriggan. Dean, first of all, the big interesting topic that you bring up here, the shadow of the very successful father. His father, Dean's father, is an Olympic boxer and has a medal to prove it. That type of coming across that with that kind of dynamic, what was in that for you as a storyteller?
Masculinity and the expectations on young men and what they're expected to be and how they're expected to behave as well. I think the easiest way in was through boxing. You know, it's not a violent sport, but there is, you know, obviously physical attributes in it that Dean doesn't want to partake in as a character.
Yeah.
And the shadow of his father literally looms large over him, but he wants to find his way, like the other characters in the book. And I just think it was an interesting way in to look at masculinity and what it takes to be a man in contemporary Irish society.
Yeah, and how one group of, it's very interesting, this happens in the case of the character of Angel as well, how when in a group of young men his own age, he kind of feels that he has to do things to peer pressure of that. Dean's dad is called the jock, you know,
it's
very, very highly thought of in the community. And then Tanya brings up the whole area of social media. I'm not giving anything away to say that very quickly we realise that there has been a sex video of Tanya thrown up on social media, and this is causing her all sorts of trouble.
Yeah, I wrote the character of Tanya like in 2014, 2015. She was in a story called Saving Tanya that went out in Young Irelanders for New Ireland. And then at the time, Tanya only appeared in the last three pages, and it was the same story, kind of a sex act was captured on camera. But in that time since then, things have got worse, not better, for girls that age and with the expectations and the use of cameras and the videos. And I would read that story with my transition year classes for the last 5-6 years, and every year would be, you know, because it's a point, because obviously it's Balbriggan and the stories in it, and to bring it into the room. And the kids, as the years go on, say, we all know Tanya. And if anything, we know as the years have gone on, they know people like Tanya who have gone out to intentionally get some sort of fame through this kind of thing. The only problem in the book is for Tanya is that it's gone onto old people media as far as she's concerned, which is WhatsApp and the Red Tops.
Some real creepy characters, though, who are also in and around.
But that's, again, that's the norm. You're talking to the 17-year-old girls, 16-year-old girls in school, and literally we'd have these chats through the English class, you know, and they'd tell you, you know, vast majority, 80%, 90% of them would be getting messages from older men.
Much older men. And I suppose it is a great way in terms of giving, like you did with the characters of Angel and Princess, getting young people who are close to these stories and some of them living these stories, getting them to tell you that's on the money, or no, you're miles off, that you're an old fella writing about that. You get over it.
Man, I'm well aware of that. You know, I'm well aware that I probably won't be able to read a lot of the characters because how ridiculous it would sound. So I'm lucky enough to have Gable to come to the launch and read. And
it did strike me, and that you've, it's amazing that you've spoken about two actors that have been there. It did strike me as I was reading the end of the book, I thought, this is like a perfect pilot setup for a series, because as the book ends, there's a real potential for their life in the way the group finishes up.
Yeah.
Have you thought about screenplays? Are you looking at developing it further than that?
I'd love to. But the audiobook itself, I'll have to give a plug to the audiobook because there's Conal Keating did Dean and Jordan Jones.
Oh, yes. She
played Tanya.
That's a very strong cast you have for the audiobook.
And Kate Gilmore then did the narrator. The narrator's only a small part, but I was privileged enough to be in the studio and listen to them, and it was amazing. I'd sit back. The engineer was on the couch and I'd sit at the front and I sat back in the couch, but they brought themselves to it. And again, you had the filter of the four actors. Again, Jordan Jones looked at me because like Tanya's 16 and she's like, how are you writing this character? And I'm saying, because you observed this over the years. But you got the audiobook, the voices and the way they interact is incredible. Yeah, I can say that because I can stand back. It's not the writing, it's the way they perform. It's amazing.
Well, listen, I certainly would be interested in hearing parts of that audiobook because it has that real performative feel off it. Congratulations, Kevin.
Thank you.
Look forward to the television series. We know who the cast is now. No, I hope it gets a further life. There's further life in the novel at any rate. Thanks for coming into us this evening. That's Kevin Curran, whose book Youth is out now and it is published by Lilliput Press. Designer Joanne Hayes has been called a maverick, artist and an innovator. Graduate of Limerick School of Fashion and Design and then Central St Martin's in London, she established her own label in 2003. Known for her highly personal, unconventional approach, she's opening her first solo exhibition this week. It's called What We Carry With Us and it opens at the Kevin Kavanagh Gallery in Dublin 8 this Thursday. And delighted to have Joanna Hayes in, Hines rather, beg your pardon, Joanne Hines in the studio with me this evening. I wonder, Joanne, what is that moment for a solo exhibition as opposed to I've got my own label or I'm working in the commercial sector, I'm getting stuff together, getting a collection together, doing all of that. How different is it then when you stand back from that business world into the world where you say, no, this is where I'm going to really get a chance to express myself and my ideas in a different forum?
Well, I was just thinking about that as I came in because I kind of experienced it today in the sense that I think for the first time in a long time, I actually felt a bit kind of, oh God.
What am I at?
What am I doing? You know? Yeah, there was that kind of idea that awareness that when it feels very personal, the work that I'm presenting in the show. And I suppose the nature of fashion is that, you know, we all know the difference between fashion and art. It's that whole like argument dialogue, which we won't go into. Mm-hmm. They are fundamentally different things. Okay, the tools might be the same thing, but with fashion, you know, there's a very direct conversation with somebody that wears the clothes on the body and it's a personal kind of connection. Mm. And I'm very aware, you know, I've obviously worked within fashion kind of, you know, in relation to my own DNA and my own kind of design references. But this feels like a very different process.
More nerve-wracking?
Well, I know it very well. Mm. So I wouldn't say nerve-wracking, but I would say possibly more exposed, maybe.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? The layer is thinner, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so if you see somebody walking down the street, maybe wearing something from a collection that you have designed for a commercial outlet or whatever, you don't think, oh, there's me on
well,
that
it's
person.
Theirs. It's theirs.
Yeah.
I mean, I know the process I went through to get there and I know the decisions that I've made. And they're not always personal decisions. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
of course, it's inherently my design, but I'm very much aware of
you
the person.
You may have been designing not quite to commission, but designing to a certain remit or a certain brief, and that was it. You had to go that route.
Yeah. And I think that has possibly been the success of the range in that, you know, as a range, it's narrow and it's niche and it's limited, but it's broad talking in the sense that There's a kind of an empathy, let's just say, with the wearer, if that's the right word.
Well, let's talk about places then where you don't have to have any empathy with anybody other than own artistic expression.
That's even worse.
But before we do that, bring me back to maybe Limerick School of Fashion and Design, first of all, and how that came to be, the route that you chose and who were the important people at that stage in your career, as it was, embarking on the career.
You know, it seems so long ago now. I mean, you know, I graduated from Limerick in 1999 and it was 5 years there, but I took a year off in between and I did that kind of work experience year in London. You know, I didn't go to college to study fashion because I don't think fashion really existed in my mind at the time. It was just, I knew I was creative. I had to respond and I was, you know,
and was there working instinctually. Was your creativity in a very visual?
It was a very personal, isolated kind of space that I kind of did, like, I think by the time I got to art college, let's just say, you know, you finish your Leaving Cert, I was very aware that it was very much my space in a sense. Because, you know, I'd spent a lot of time like living with myself, making stuff and, you know, not really knowing really. A lot of the time you just don't know what you're doing. You're just kind of responding and knowing that you have to kind of.
Well, there's no pressure on you. There was no pressure on you other than to do what you felt like doing.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is, in a sense, it's a wonderful thing to be able to do that, you know. There is a freedom in that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
There's a kind of a reverence in that. But it was also, I kind of knew it was quite possibly the only thing that I would really kind of commit to. Like, you know, like I really wanted to kind of jump into something, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Kind of suit my character, let's just say. So, you know, I went to, you know, art college with the intention of being a painter. And then when I kind of walked into the painting room, you know, no disrespect or anything, but I just thought, this is not the pace for me.
I'm not at home here.
It just didn't. There was something that I felt, and then and then I think it was just the immediacy of fashion. I think I don't know what it was.
Was it fabric? Was it fabric that started to speak to you, or what was it?
I think it was, possibly the communication of it, the overt like being able to communicate.
Well, let's tweet something and maybe you can speak directly to what kind of thoughts, kind of communication is at stake here. The first image that I showed you at RTE Arena, if you want to see these Joanne Hines designs. Would you refer to these simply as designs, or how do you refer to these
You know, it's funny because you could look at them and say, yeah, I mean, everything is design, isn't it, at the end of the day? And it's that whole conversation between design and art, whatever. And I don't really care what they're called. They're digital images that have been printed on archive paper that are, like, they're digital scans of, I kind of call them gestural compositions of found objects and collected objects that I've put together.
What have you found in this particular, kind of three big elements within this particular one that I've tweeted now on at RTE?
Yeah, I mean, that first one, the black and white one, it's from an extract of writing called Carol Craig. So it was, I go to London quite a bit, and you know that idea when you go to a different city, your mind is just kind of reacts in a different way. So I kind of have this, I like visiting vintage clothing stores and vintage stores. So I kind of went on a mission to find the oldest, most decrepit dresses I could possibly find that were literally falling apart and threadborne. And I was amazed that in London, that still existed, that there was somebody that actually handed down this dress from, I don't know, 1930 or 1940, potentially. I would think from the stitching, there's no overlocking on it, that it was a home sewing kind of garment. Anyway, it's black and white, and it's
a single garment. I thought of it as a three part.
It's that kind of illusion of a blouse with a skirt, so it makes it look like it's a skirt with
two
a blouse.
Items,
but it would have been a very popular kind of idea at the time. But
and then the leaf like structure, stem like structure that's on top of that's one item.
That's a bronze wall piece, a wall light, I suppose. It's an
and are they of a period, or are they from the same time?
It's about 100 years old, the light fixture. And the dress, no, I think the dress is kind of 1940s, I would think, 1950s. But
so when you put those, as I thought, three pieces, but two pieces together in that fashion, are you looking at it almost in like a collage, or like a sculpture in some ways?
In
your mind?
Sense that, well, sculptural, yeah. I mean, is gestural, anything with the hands. I mean, for me, it's a bit like working in a sketchbook or collating things, or, you know, putting them together, just working with assemblage, really, putting things together. But what I was kind of interested in, I started the whole idea of the show never really existed in my head. I just wanted to write. So I started writing. But I didn't know what to write about because I didn't want to tell stories, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Because I'm not really very interested in the idea of plot or narrative structure or anything like that. When I heard or did a couple of courses, and I thought, oh no, I've done all that discipline in fashion. I just want to stream of consciousness kind of. So I found myself writing about kind of the nothingness in a sense. And then when I, with this, I felt like I ended up writing about this dress and Googling the name of the designer and then imagining. So I was kind of, you know, imagining the lives of the people that might have worn them or used the objects.
So within the exhibition then, do we get the pieces themselves and those bits of writing, or how does that work?
The artwork, the scanned artwork is framed there. There's like, there's diptychs, the three of them. And they're really nice. And I think I was really surprised by that because I've never done that before. I've never made, let's just say, an artwork before, if you know what I'm saying. So it's like a different...
Totally different discipline.
Different discipline.
How do you think, I mean, and maybe this, I don't know if it feeds more into fashion than art, to use that division that we've been talking about quite a bit. Given that you studied in Limerick and then went on to study in London, subsequently in St. Martin's, how did your Irishness, how does it and how did it impact on what you do in terms of fashion and art, do you think?
Oh, hugely. Hugely. And I wasn't aware of it until I was out of Ireland, let's just say. You know, I mean, I was happy to go to London. I'd spent a year there kind of during my degree. But and they, you know, they said to me in Limerick, you know, you really need to do a master's. It wasn't that I wanted to go to St. Martin's to do a master's. Yeah. It never even entered my mind. It was just, they said to me, you need to continue, you know, this via sketchbook work. Let's just say there was something that was unresolved or that needed to go further. So like when I just remember I had done, you know, the whole kind of like 6 month, 1 year internship in London in Shoreditch at the time. So I had dipped into that world.
Right.
But I was very aware of the kind of my Irishness. And, you know, Louise Wilson at the time, Professor Louise Wilson, who was running the course, you know,
she was very important influence, I think. Yeah,
she was hugely influential in a very I won't say nurturing, but it certainly was in a sense. She kind of went about it in her own way, but it was very powerful.
I suppose in her way that was particular. I'm guessing that she crafted that way for you.
She did. She liked the Irish for some reason. She's just to say the grit of the Irish, you know. She liked that kind of aesthetic.
Which do you want? I'm going to tweet one more. Do you want to tweet the image that's on the card that's in the invitation, or do you want to tweet the lime green? You make the decision. Which one would
the
you
lime
rather?
Green,
right? So
yeah.
We're going to do number three there for Michelle, who's doing the tweeting out in the production area at RTE Arena. So again, we're looking at, I think it's three pieces, but perhaps you're going to put me right on this one, are you?
Well, it's a very heavy Duchess satin, kind of very peculiar green. I was really drawn to that because, you know, colours have kind of funny representations, and it's not a colour I get to use in my collection. So I was drawn to that. There is a ceramic kind of metal flower that's kind of suspended from it, and then there's broken Waterford crystal bowls that have been broken up.
Oh yes, I can see the glass now as I look closer to the, at the image.
There's a lot of crystal in the show work. And it's kind of just going back to work.
And again, is it in terms of expression or communication, is it simply that you're looking for something that to you feels and looks right, and then maybe gives you the impulse to make one of these stories in and around it? Is that what you're looking for?
I think it's always about, you know, thinking about what should you not use or what could you not, you know. And the idea of working with crystal, when I say crystal, I don't mean crystals like tiny crystals. I mean, you know, working with actual crystal on clothes. Yeah. You know, I suspended large crystal from garments and, you know, in my MA collection. And I think it was just that. And again, this show is going back to the beginning to kind of reconcile where I'm at.
Well, listen, people can get more of a sense of what's going on at the solo exhibition. It's called What We Carry With Us. It's at the Kevin Cavanagh Gallery, Chancery Lane in Dublin 8, from this Thursday, 20th of July, through until the 4th of August, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m, Tuesday to Saturday. KevinCavanagh.ie or JoanneHines.com for full details on that. But that is our lot for this evening. Amadine Pastor-Devine and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Acting Grufferty was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 6:30 here on RTE Radio 1.